Today, we've got a few things to do. So we're going to go through some of the chapter 10 material having to do with input and output on the system level. This is going to be directly applicable to Shell Lab, specifically the do redirect function, and which involves the last three of the traces that you are graded on. We'll demonstrate a little bit of that and show you some of the background material for that. But first, we want to return to the activity we gave you on the last class on Wednesday. So let's take a look. So please call that up. If you have a paper version, great. If you have a PDF version, that'll work too. I believe it is called signals.pdf.
Sorry, Matt, can you say that again? I was on the phone with somebody at work.
I didn't hear the question. Sorry, say again, please.
Can you just say that again? I was on the phone with somebody at work. I'm sorry.
Okay. I was beginning the class, talking about what we're going to talk about today. Incidentally, this will all be recorded and you can review it later. So, but yeah, I was saying we're going to talk about chapter 10, but first we're going to look at our activity from before. So this. So this is from the last class. Please call us up, and I'd like to hear from you all about what you came up with, both for the graph and for the questions we asked on the second page here. So. Share button on the bottom of the screen. Or you could also verbally describe this to us if you like. Who do we have for volunteers? We have a raise hand function and a share function in Zoom. So let's try that out. I'll give you a minute to look at what you got and try this. Y'all didn't think because we're doing classes from home, I wasn't like going to ask you questions about this stuff, right? Does the awkward silence not work as well this way? Okay. So I guess maybe the noon class didn't get to this one yet. Incidentally, welcome everyone from the noon class who is here. We are combining the classes today.
Yeah, I'd be happy to participate. Where's the activity?
David, it's linked on the schedule, right?
That's kind of what I was asking you about when I first asked my question. I apologize. You referenced an activity that I was just clueless about.
Gotcha.
I'm not into the awkward silence, so I'd love to participate.
Got it. Okay. For those of you who saw this activity before, what can you answer? I know some of y'all have something to say. I mean, I could just show you the answers, but that would spoil it for you, wouldn't it? So if not everyone got a chance to check this out, then we can revisit this on the next class on Monday then. And maybe I will threaten to call someone at random. So please do make a graph and answer these questions. This is here for your benefit. So we'll return to this. Does anyone else have any questions and comments about previous classes and Shell Lab and anything else that's on your mind? Okay, let's get into our lecture then. Okay. So this is, we're here to talk about input-output redirection. Fix that, yeah. So just some comments on Shell Lab generally. We have this command, make test 01, make test 02, et cetera. So we were discussing this with some of y'all in help hours in previous classes. You have to write a good bit of Shell Lab before you can start getting through these tests. So maybe the first one just test quit. So that's easy. That's one of the built-in commands that doesn't do anything but call exit. But after that, you know, we're going to be running multiple jobs, some of them background, testing the jobs list, testing signal handlers. All these things assume a pretty advanced, if not complete, version of eval. Of course, you did a sort of basic version, so you're not done just because you had eval creating simple processes from your demo. But you'll also need a jobs list that works, and having a jobs list that updates correctly requires a sigchild handler that works. Have any of you encountered why that's important? Like, what does sigchild handler have to do with the jobs list anyway?
I don't want to give anything away, but it's going to delete a job.
Yeah, that's that is correct. So, to be a little more general, sigchild handler is going to respond to any changes in a child process. The sigchild handler is run by the shell, the parent process, the process that created those child processes. And when one of the child processes that the shell created, when it stops with sig t stop, or is interrupted by sig int, or ends normally because it finished, when any of those three things happen, sigchild handler will respond and deal with it correctly. I do see some of the chats about the slides I'm looking at now. Yes, they'll be posted on the schedule page. They're not now, but hey, you're all seeing them on the share right now, right? So you can't claim I'm like depriving you of access to these slides, but they'll be posted. Don't worry, they're always posted. You know, we have a great deal of files to record and things to do on our new system that we haven't done before. So sorry that things aren't always as smooth as we'd like. Anyway, so talking about Shell Lab testing. There's make test followed by some number. What that does is exactly what's in the trace file, trace01.txt. So you can actually see what's in that text file and run them yourself. So run something similar yourself on your shell just to see what the results are before you kind of start seeing what the autograder says. So we have make our test 01. So that runs the exact same trace, but on the reference shell. So that's what the two things are being compared. So they need to behave the same. They also need to output the same text. And they must match exactly. If you have like slightly different wording, go back and fix your wording, and then you'll get the points. Check tsh.py runs all the tests. So this is like when you're getting closer to done. You know, we don't want to run all the tests when you're just working on fixing a particular one. But you can, when you're getting closer to the end, do that. This might remind you of some of the like data lab procedure. And the Shell Lab write-up has a bunch of stuff under checking your work. In fact, it's a bunch of good stuff in general. I still have my paper copy. You all got one at one time, right? So checking your work. Looks like this has some stuff about the tests. And there's even a little diff program on page 6 for finding out exactly what was different about your outputs. CheckTSH does this. Autolab does this. Also, I'm going to point out this hints section, section 6. on page six. So says a bunch of things about the system calls you need to use, such as wait, PID, kill, fork, exec, VE, set PG, ID, sig, proc, mask. So it says how to use the kill function to send a signal to a process group, how to block signals, eval, that may or may not work in your shell, things about signals, and also when you have a segmentation fault, which I would anticipate everyone at some point is going to encounter this segmentation fault when you're writing your shell, when you have an error involving pointers. This often happens in text processing. So we have a whole thing about using GDB to help you with segmentation faults. This is all in the shell lib write-up that you've had for a while. Questions on this? H.C. And this is available throughout the TSH program. It's already been declared for you. You just have to maintain it by using add jobs and delete jobs. Add job and delete job. So, and you'll actually call these with jobs as one of the arguments to say like which jobs list are you modifying, and then the other parameters. You can go look at the bottom of tsh.c and see exactly what add job and delete job require as parameters. So these have been, these helper functions are written, but you have to call them and with the right stuff. This add job intentionally flawed the example there. I think we had a similar example in the slides. It's flawed because it has a race condition, which we introduced in the last class a bit. So that's shell lab stuff. So shell block, signal blocking will be your fix for this. So some other things. Wait PID is a confusing name. I mean, we're really going to use wait FG to do the stopping. Wait PID is really doing the reaping in your sig child handler. Wait FG can be a pretty simple loop. So all these things we'll talk about with you as you're getting further along in your shell. So refer back to these. Yes, the slides will be posted as usual. FG PID, get job PID. So, and you can use sleep of one to slow down that for loop a bit, or that while loop. All right, so I'm gonna talk to you about input and output and show you what this has to do with shell lab. So just as we like to do in these lectures, we want to start with some basic things, looking at the low level of what's going on in our computer systems. So we're just gonna start with a basic thing you're probably familiar with that you didn't think we were gonna really need to define that well. We're just gonna say like, what is a file? So what is a file? I think you're familiar with your computer having files. In fact, you've, you know, been submitting these for your homework assignments for a long time and putting things in them, stuff like that. So let's just sort of put this in context. Our computer holds a bunch of information. It can store things as bytes. But we want to have a wide variety of things. We don't just want just plain bytes on a disk. You want to have some of them hold your source code, and some of them hold your text documents, and some of them hold other things. So, but all these things are data, and some, you know, bits of data go with together as a set that we'll call a file. All have the same type and are you know, conceptually linked in some way, such as been part of one assignment or one image or whatever. So you have different formats. Some of them are text. Some of them are images or videos or audio or instructions for a processor. We would call that binary executable, you know, a program you can run. So you've dealt with all these formats too. So none of this is new to you. And then also these files get organized in some way. So they're not just kind of distributed anywhere on a disk, but they're in a organized in some way that you can find them, store them with things that are related, things like that. All of these things are, you know, also true of, say, papers in a file cabinet. You don't just put them in arbitrary order, but you'll put them in some meaningful order. So that's why we have these metaphors, you know, file is a word we used long before we had computers. And so we're kind of using this as a metaphor, since we're already used to storing things this way. So that's why we've kind of chosen these little pictures. Is this consistent with how you've been using these words? What do you think?
Definitely.
Yes.
Okay, so so now what? Okay, a little more technical. So we have a sequence of bytes in a file. So we can define it this way, byte 0, byte 1, and so on up to m minus 1 if there are a total of m bytes. So if there are, say, 100 bytes, there would be 0 through 99 there. That's, you know, we're just used to counting starting from 0 in these things. But also notice that we say sequence, that the order is important. So B0 and B1 come at the beginning. They're not just a set, but they are a sequence. But you're used to thinking of a file like a piece of source code or a text document as a file, which they are. But we also have files which you may not be used to using as such, but they represent like something in hardware. So on a Linux system, our input-output devices are represented as files. So a piece of the disk, the device that stores data, is referenced as a device file slash dev slash something. And also the terminal, the thing that your shell or your SSH session writes to in terms of text, that is represented as a file also and can be read from and written to like a file. So we call this an abstraction. So it is used for all sorts of things, not just the sort of plain files that you're used to. And the file abstraction tends to be a widely used, especially in Unix systems. So for all sorts of things. So the operating system kernel itself is represented as a file in different ways. First, the actual executable instructions that the kernel has and runs are in this file slash boot slash something. It's just a big executable file full of instructions. But also while the kernel is running, it has various data structures, information about things it's doing, and, well, most importantly, all the processes, because we've talked a bunch about how processes represent all the different programs the computer's running and that the operating system context switches between them. And processes have their own instruction pointer and their own memory space and their own files, stuff like that. So all that goes under this file system called PROC, P-R-O-C, short for processes. That's something interesting that we'll look at very soon. So we like this abstraction of a file because it's applicable to all sorts of different things. It's very flexible, and we have a single interface, a single abstraction for which we can open and close and read and write, and this can apply to regular files, it can apply to devices, it can apply to, which could be disks or terminals, it can apply to network sockets, all sorts of things with the same abstraction of file and the same system calls to manipulate them, open, close, read and write. And then we have this other idea with files, which is that there is some current position, some somewhere in between B of 0 and B of K over in the middle of the file somewhere, that is currently next to be read. Since these are ordered, there's this sort of assumption that we'll read them in order. And so the any file has a that's being read has a position, well, which byte is in the middle of getting read here. This is sort of linked to the legacy of files as, you know, originally being stored on magnetic tapes. And tapes, you know, you've probably seen a tape, even if it's an audio tape, it has a reels on each end and the tape goes from one side to the other. And there's like a head that reads it in the middle. So the tape's going by and the head reads whatever's at that position. So that's how we got used to reading files this way, but the idea still persists today, whether we're talking about the head reading bytes off a magnetic disk or even our fancy solid-state disk that we use today. We still sort of maintain a byte position because even when they're not stored on the linear medium like a tape, We still read them in an order, and very often we still read them from beginning to end. So we have the idea of seeking to a certain position within a file. We have files that have types. These are not the same as like file formats, like images or audio files or whatever, but just strictly from a citizen's point of view, a regular file is arbitrary data of any sort, whether it's text or binary or image or whatever. But that's separate from a directory, which a directory is actually a file. It's a special type of file that just holds links to other files. We also have sockets, which are used to communicate with things over a network. So, you know, you're receiving video and audio from me right now. That's all arriving at your computer over a network socket. Those bytes are coming in order. They're not mixed up. You're seeing, you know, one moment, you know, my words come in order and the frames of video come in order. Otherwise, that'd be very confusing. So that network socket is sending you bytes, and you are your computer is reading them with the same, you know, read operations that it would as if these bytes were coming out of a file. And in fact, when this gets recorded and posted online, there will be a regular file instead of a network socket representing this audio and video stuff that we've recorded and posted for you. Okay. So we also, there are some other types that we're not going to really get into here that are more special cases, pipes, symbolic links, character and block devices. So those are all more specialized things that when you're digging deeper in an operating system, you will encounter. Of course, you know, regular day-to-day use files, regular files and directories are the ones you see all the time. Network sockets you're using all the time, but a lot of times you're, you know, your web browser or the program that's playing this video or whatever kind of handles all that. But it's all in there as a file, you know, underneath. So this file abstraction is everywhere. So regular files can have arbitrary data. We do sort of draw a distinction between text files and binary files. Text files that we're used to reading because they contain things encoded with ASCII or perhaps in a more modern situation, the wider set of characters called Unicode. But binary files contain, you know, everything else. Object files are executables, you know, JPEG images you're probably familiar with. These are things that were you to open them in an editor. They wouldn't all, you know, be necessarily printable on the screen. However, you know, all these bytes do have a value between 0 and 255, and you can represent them in hexadecimal. But the operating system kernel or you know, software, when opening a file, doesn't really care. Like a byte is a byte. Whether, you know, you can read that byte, and what you decide to do with it is up to the program. This kind of gets back to what we were dealing with in Data Lab, that, you know, data is really just, you know, bits in context. So the context matters. In one context, this byte would represent the letter C, but in some other context, it would represent some machine instruction. In text files, we have lines that are ended with a new line character. You've seen this at least a few times, backslash n representing a single character that says go to the next line. That is represented hexadecimal with the A character that we see here. So that of course is, you know, 10 in decimal, A in hexadecimal. There are actually some differences on different systems about how to represent the end of a line. I won't worry about this too much, but on Windows and other certain protocols, there sometimes will be two characters at the end of a line. Carriage return followed by line feed. What do these names mean? Well, they really derive from the typewriter, which was, of course, very common when these computer things were being developed. So you would have one function to take the carriage, the thing with the ink on it, and like move it all the way over. And then line feed was the thing that like turned to move the paper down. So that's where those names come from. Okay. So directories, these really contain what are called links, which is just connecting a name, which because we give files names, but connecting that with some location on the disk, which is where the file really is. And these directories also have some entries. Again, you've been seeing these for a while, but let's revisit this and define these. The single dot represents the directories itself. It's a link back to itself. You know, we end up using this frequently when just wanting to reference the current directory with a dot. And then two dots is a link to the parent directories. So directories also form a hierarchy. It's not just processes that have parents. So directories have parents also. Well, let's look at that in the hierarchy. There's some commands, make dir, ls. You've been using these all semester. But we have a hierarchy on our system, beginning with a single slash representing the very beginning, the root of the file system. And then everything else, something after the slash. So all semester you've been working with files that are in slash home slash, you know, your username would be here instead of Bryant or DROH. And then a file under that directory might be hello.c. And then every process can have a certain current working directory, sometimes called CWD. There is a PWD command for displaying it. So, you know, your shell that you log into might have a current working directory of your home directory. Of course, at the same time, one of your classmates is logged in and their shell has its own working directory. And so when that student uses, you know, dot or dot slash something, something, they're referencing something in their home directory and you're referencing something in yours. Also, everything else, so we're not just talking about your files, but all the programs you use, such as Bash, is stored in a directory called bin, which is referencing the fact that these are typically compiled binary executable programs that are not really readable, but are executable. So Bash is one of those, you know, your web browser and your PDF viewer and your compiler, all those things are binary programs that you run. We have slash dev for devices, such as terminals and disks and all that that the system uses. We have this directory for configuration files, abbreviated, et cetera, sometimes at etc, etc, stores things like who can log into the system and what are the various rules for things. And then there's this whole area slash USR, which has all kinds of stuff, including programs like editors, but also a whole bunch of stuff that lets you compile things, such as the header files when you try and compile a program. So that's just a little overview of what's in here. You, the day-to-day user, pretty much focus on this area that belongs to you under home. But everything on the system lives somewhere in this hierarchy, starting with the slash. Is this consistent with what you have observed as your time as users on Systems Lab or other systems? Or what does this make you think of in your experience?
This helps make sense of, you know, the headers at least. From my understanding, I guess that include file or directory there is like pointed to by some part in the like C programming process. Like for instance, like if you include std.h, it's going to look there, correct? Like, I don't know what mechanism does that, but.
Sure. Well, that's really the preprocessor. If you really want to get to it, CPP, if you remember using that a long time ago. So, that thing, its job is to handle includes and it knows where to look. So that's all, you know, defined by how the preprocessor works. But, you know, every program, that's the preprocessor knows where to look for its specific things. You know, if you run the program to change your password, it knows that the password file is stored at etc password. So, you know, these programs all have specific jobs and they know where to look on the system for their stuff. So, these are all specific to a program with its own little job.
Yeah, I had to look into that a little bit because I wanted to test some of the CS app programs, and of course to include, you have to include like all of his.
And what you're going to see is there's a difference between using the angle braces and the quotation marks and how you include things. That's a little subtle detail. I don't want to go too far into just so we can move ahead in the lecture. Let's just look at absolute and relative path names here. So So this is two ways you can reference the same file. So this hello.c file here could be referenced both as its absolute path, so slash home slash dro slash hello.c. That's one way to reference that file. But the same file, if the current working directory is slash home slash Bryant, as it says over here. So this guy, assuming he had permission to read the file, could say the whole absolute path that we just looked at, or from here, another way to do it. And it's not a coincidence, it's called path, right? You see these lines, you can say, okay, instead of starting from slash, we can start from this blue spot, Bryant, dot, dot takes us up, and then dro takes us back here and here. So those are, I didn't mean to click. Those are two ways to get to the same file, absolute path and relative path. This comes up a lot, especially when, say, you're copying files or using CD. And I've gotten, and I'm sure the other TAs have gotten all sorts of questions throughout the semester when someone has, they've typed a whole thing they want to change directory to, but they typed home without a slash before it. Or the flip side is like they were in their own directory and they wanted to type CD 2467, which really meant the 2467 under their home directory, but they typed slash 2467, which was referring to the top of the hierarchy. And then they got command, directory not found. And then they got upset and came to us. And then we were like, oh, well, that's an absolute path. So there's a difference between starting with the slash, starting from the root, and starting with something relative to the current working directory. So absolute path, relative path, two different ways of referring to a file. If you don't know the difference, it's going to be confusing and frustrating. So that's something you've probably seen already, and hopefully we've sort of put into context here. Okay. What else is this? Is this remind you of anything else you've done this semester, though? Let's just talk about using these files then. So you've been using them probably in your Java programs also. So you have this idea of like opening a file. This is, to allow a program to read from a file, start by opening it, which doesn't, actually read anything or write anything yet. But we specify what file to open, here is an absolute path to this, text file. Let's see hosts, there are these flags with how to read a file that's read only, and then the result of this open system call is what's called a file descriptor, which is just a number, an integer, that every process has some number of file descriptors. The things that process has open, it references with numbers. And this open system call, like our other system calls, like fork and exec, returns a negative value when it does not work. So that's what this less than zero is doing. So if a file, open fails for, maybe it doesn't exist. Maybe there's a permissions problem. Maybe the disk has gone wrong. There is a negative value reported to the open system call. And so this if block around open catches those error cases. But really, again, keep in mind that this isn't just an if, this isn't just a conditional. There's an open system call happening here. So that's like a real action that has side effects, affects the process. And then afterwards, the error is checked for in this if block. So that's consistent with how we've seen other system calls. Open is like that as well. But file descriptors are ints, which is a sort of fairly simple abstraction. And in fact, there are some default file descriptors for every process. 0 for standard input, 1 for standard output, 2 for standard error. So we've even seen a little bit of this like when dealing with shell script stuff. And that's what makes pipes work, that a process can have, normally it reads input from terminal, but you could also have it read input from a file, things like that. And of course, we have the analog of this, which is closing a file, which is fairly simple, but does allow a program to like finish writing to a file. We got a question?
Yeah, so this is really helpful. I really wanted to kind of understand file descriptors better. And I encountered it in the mock code, the provided shell app. where you use Duke too. And I was a little confused as to how that works. So maybe after class, if you want to, if you have a quick on that now.
Unless today. So yeah, we're going to be doing that in the slides.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, it's opening and closing. Those are not that exciting though. So reading, we have this idea of reading from a file descriptor. So for some, this you know supposes that a file has been opened already and that we have some number stored for what that's going to be, some file descriptor number. That int will go here, and we tell read where to read that data to. So this is some buffer, some address, and then some number of maximum number of bytes to read. That's if there weren't that many there. But then the read system call returns how many things it actually read into this thing buff. Anyway, and then of course, as always, checking for a negative value as all system calls return something negative when they fail or error for some reason. So, and there are the possibility of reading less than the amount requested. So even if 512 is here, maybe fewer were read, maybe, you know, there just weren't that many, or the disk is slow and can only do a little bit at a time. This is called a short count, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. A very familiar situation might be like getting a file over a network. You're trying to download a 100 megabyte file. So you're trying to read a lot of them, but they don't all arrive immediately because your network takes time. So that's, you know, where you would get some sort of progress bar. You get like read a little bit and a little bit more and a little bit more and eventually get the whole file. And how much you get in each chunk kind of depends on your network, and you don't really find out until you're in the midst of downloading it. Yes.
Can you just quickly describe like what opening a file actually means again? I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, really, the end result is that you're getting a file descriptor. You're getting this, this int. And without that int, a process can't operate on a file until it's been opened, and that the process now has its file descriptor number. But really, you know, it's a system call. So like all system calls, it's asking the operating system kernel to do something for a process. You know, and I like to, you know, I like to call processes, you know, living in a little bubble. Well, that's great, except that that limits their power, you know, so processes have to ask the operating system kernel really to do anything special, such as create a new process. That's why you've seen fork, you know, execute a new thing with exec. Well, opening a file, that's asking the kernel to do something, you know, outside of that little process's bubble, and give the process back a small int representing where the process can now go and do its reading and writing from.
Okay, so it kind of like it points to a place in the disk like that's special.
Well, again, the operating system is going to handle all that. So, you know, and again, since this isn't our operating systems class, we're going to discuss this kind of from the program's point of view or the programmer's point of view. Without getting too much into how the kernel accomplishes that, the program just knows I can make system calls. Programs can make system calls, and how that actually gets accomplished, the program doesn't necessarily need to know. So a program can say open on some file. Like the kernel will figure out where on the disk that's really located in terms of like how many bytes into the disk or, you know, which different piece of hardware it's on. You know, okay. Regular process is ignorant of all that and wants to be ignorant of all that. It just says, hey, I asked to open up this file. I expect it to get done for me. That's the operating system's job. But making a system call says, go do this. And you know, there's a manual page on the open system call, and it's a defined interface for all programs to use. So
thank you.
I mean, how it works, we're intentionally abstracting that away, that the process can just call open, call read and write, doesn't really need to know that much about how it gets done. It just, you know, it either gets done or we get a negative result when there's an error. You know, I mean, this is great, right? I mean, you can write, you know, this even goes back to like our Hello World program even requires system calls to print to the screen, but like the Hello World program doesn't need to know anything about, you know, the hardware that you're printing to or anything like that. It's all abstracted away. So these abstractions are what make it possible for us to even write simple programs. So, I showed a little read example. Anyway, we're not having you call read and write and all that directly, although we will be having you call open and close because we're all trying to accomplish input-output redirection. So I'll show you read and write here, but really here's a simple C program that reads from standard in and writes to standard out. These are just macros for the 0 and 1. And anyway, this is reading and writing, but we really want to talk about input-output redirection while we have time. So let's look, we'll skip some of the metadata stuff. Let's look at redirection. So the OS kernel for any process and for all processes uses these small ints to represent file descriptors, standard in, standard out, standard error, and then maybe some more files that got opened. And I can, you know, show us an example of this, which we normally do in class when we're all on systems lab. It works a little better that way, but we'll figure out a way. When a new file gets opened with open system call, you know, file descriptors 3 and 4 are created here, and every file descriptor that's open has some position and some reference count, and it references some real file somewhere. So let's get into the redirect bit. So what we're really to do a fork. Really what I want to get into is this question of something like this. So have you seen this greater than symbol used on a command line? I think you have. We've kind of told you to do it on a few occasions, starting with the intro lab. And when else did we do this? Maybe the bash shell exercise. I don't know. When have y'all used this thing? Am I forgetting anything recently, or have you used it in some other context?
Maybe that nifty trick in the show lab handout, but except it's a little less than, and it seems to formatting seems to be particular.
I'm gonna have to start asking for people other than David to tell me stuff. I mean, other than Michael, sorry, David. Not that I don't like hearing from you, but I'm hoping that there are other people out there. And I guess there's some discussion in the chat that I missed, but looks like y'all are on it. So, you know, what this command here does is, you know, list the directory with ls, but instead of print it to the screen, as you're very, I think you've all run the ls command, instead of print it to the screen, write the output to this file, foo.txt. And I think I made the claim when we were talking about, you know, bash scripting, that this is great because a program like ls, you know, doesn't need to know anything about disks or files or whatever. All ls knows is it prints stuff to standard out, file descriptor 1, and, you know, it acts like, oh, I'm writing to file descriptor 1, so I'm writing to the screen of whoever called ls. Well, if ls is invoked like this, none of that output gets written to the screen. But as far as ls is concerned, it's still just writing to file descriptor 1, and the fact that file descriptor 1 went into a file instead of to the screen doesn't affect anything. So this is what this dupe to system call does. It says, okay, so if this processor had a file descriptor 4, like from calling open on some file B, calls open on B, and we now have file descriptor 4, this dupe to thing says, hey, substitute 4 in to where 1 was before. So now file descriptor 1 before was A, which we'll call the terminal, has been replaced with B, which is some file. But ls is going to write to file descriptor 1 like it always does, and that'll just end up in a file instead. So, you know, do this on your own next time you have SSH in a systems lab, or, you know, whatever system you have that has bash on it, you should be able to type ls and write it to a file. And then you can read this file in your editor or with the cat command or whatever. Dupe2 handles duplicating file descriptors and can do a little substitution here. So this is what you need to do in Shell Lab. So what that's really doing is saying, and for file descriptor one points to, well, file A really the device, and we can look at this. We have a little activity where we look at this on Systems Lab. We'll write to the terminal, but after dupe2, now file descriptor one is new file descriptor. So you will add this in to your do redirect function. And then you can call close. So you're going to call open, dupe2, and close in do redirect. So the test case is provided in the traces. So ls-l on tsh.c. So it'll write a file called test out. So like, if you haven't done anything with do redirect yet, your shell is going to treat this whole thing as one command. But really the command here is this bit, and this is all that gets executed. But this says open a file with this name and change standard out to be that file. So we should see, instead of ls-l, all this stuff printing out to the screen, it should appear in this file. If you haven't implemented do redirect, then ls is going to try and list this thing, and this thing. Ls sees three arguments. But really, what the shell should say, ls gets only these two arguments, and then this is to handle the output redirect. Questions on this? Okay, we also have input redirect. So this says myread40 is a program we provided to test this. So this says read 40 bytes from standard input, except that standard input, instead of being the user's keyboard, is going to be this file tsh.c. So does it read tsh.c as standard input to this the programming? And if you haven't implemented do redirect, then this isn't going to read the files from tsh.c. And if you have, it will. So we have traces for testing that. All right. So we have some tips for you on this. Here they are. Open and close. We have examples in the text on exactly how that's used. There's even a manual page in Linux. You don't need to call read and write, because ls is going to do all the read, or whatever the program is that execve calls will do all the read and write. So you don't need to do any read and write. You use dupe2. Again, that's in the text. And you have to do a little more. You have to declare an int to hold that file descriptor, because file descriptors are simply ints. Check the system call for errors. Again, if open fails, we need to know. Can't just act like you can read and write from this thing if open failed. And the common reason being, of course, that either the file, trying to read from a file that doesn't exist, or you're trying to write to a file that you don't have access to. When someone tries to do input redirect from something that doesn't exist, we need this error to be no such file directory. Again, your errors would need to match what tshref has. So, questions? This is what you need to do in Shell Lab. We can show you some more about file descriptors in a little activity involving procfs. So we'll send that to you this way. And like I said, I'd like to see your see what you've come up with for process graphs on Wednesday's activity. So I'm not giving you the answers until y'all make some effort here. So show me. I don't know. Don't really get to see much like in terms of facial expressions here. So tell me. Show me something. And then we'll, look at what you got and show you what we came up with for process graphs. So I'm here for your questions. We can chat about stuff. And of course, we have our help hours on Tuesday, Thursdays, also on Zoom. Use that remote page, click on the second link for help hours. Of course, always email us and stay in touch that way. Caitlin's not well today and won't be able to do the 12 o'clock lecture, but I see some of you all, we've had a combined class here and we'll post the recording. So hopefully that's helpful. Let us know if that's working or not working for you. And floor's open. What you got?
I wanted to ask, can we just start on this part over here where we work on the opening and closing right away while we don't have to finish the rest of Shell Lab, or?
Okay, yeah, I see your question. Yeah, what order? So that's a good question. The interesting thing about Do Redirect is that it really is pretty independent of a lot of other stuff in Shell Lab. So it doesn't really involve signal handlers or anything like that. So you can easily do this last, or you can do it sooner. You do need to be able to fork an exec, but of course you've already done that if you've made it through the demo, which you have. So you can work on this kind of independently of the other parts. It's kind of just a totally different part of Shell Lab and represents 6 out of your 40 points. So best that you get those 6 points.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you very much.
I have a question. It's kind of detailed. Sorry. Given code of Shell Lab.
Hold on for just a second. Let me give someone a chance. I'm happy for detailed questions, but if there's anyone else has maybe a quicker one, let's try and get that in, and I will call on Michael in just a minute. And if y'all don't come up with a short question, I'm going to talk about this for who knows how long. So calm down. What do you got? 5? Anyone? Go, Michael.
There's one in the chat. I'll read it for you, Matt. It says, it's by Andres. It's for Monday. How do you want us to describe the activity you showed us if we don't have cameras?
Screen share. So if you did it by hand and you don't have a camera, you have no camera whatsoever. Like, you can't take a photograph of this. I'm like, delighted to know there might be someone who doesn't have a camera or smartphone in their pocket all the time, but I'm skeptical that this is the case. But if you were like take some sort of photo, I guess what I'm saying is, if you have this as a file on your computer of any sort, whether it's something you drew on the computer or something you took a photograph of, this share button on the bottom should allow you to share any arbitrary file, whether it's like a picture of something you drew or a document that you typed up or whatever. So, part of why I threw this out here is I was like, let's practice this whole sharing thing. We just figured it out, this week among the course staff. You should be able to share. Is this something y'all can, like, can someone just try this? Is this something that, do you have to get permission from us to share your screen or something? I don't know.
I could actually try it with my question.
Sure. Okay. Let's see it and let's find out if this works. And I might have to stop my share first, because I come to think of it, it's probably like not supposed to let you like interrupt my slide.
Yeah. Yeah, it says you cannot start screen share with a lot of the other participants.
Okay. Try now.
All right. Cool. Yeah. Here we go. So this is the provided. This is the original.
Let me use this opportunity to tell folks, if you want to show me your stuff, simply inform me that you'd like to screen share, and I will give you the floor the way I've just given Michael the screen. So no, you don't have to. You can't override my screen share, but I can give it to you. Okay. So Michael, you want to talk about Duke 2?
Yeah. So it looks like you're essentially pointing standard error. So number 2, right? That's standard error.
That's right.
To standard in. And I just have a question as to why that's done, because you'll see that we use the F, the original code uses the fprintf function often here. Let me just go to another one where it actually, so in the context, I can't find it, but I saw that fprintf, actually the file that it pointed to was standard error, I thought. Let me see. Apparently not. Anyway, I guess my question is, like, what? Why is that done?
Can you go back up to that first dupe two?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty obscure. Like, you know, we're running this. The thing that grades your shell lab is like fairly complicated, and we want to see all the output, including. So normally errors and regular output are separated, and we didn't. I didn't really have time to go into that much, but like it's actually I think a pretty good design decision to say we want errors and regular output to go in to different places because you know we it's not unusual to say. To redirect output of a program into another program, but the error message that that first program prints, well, is probably not expected by the second program, and in fact, we would want to see that on the screen. So, like, let me come up with an example if I can do this on the fly.
And my share.
I just did.
Oh, you did. Cool. You can do that. Sweet.
Yes. Okay. So. Let me see if I can come up with a good example for this. So, what's something that prints something, reads something, and prints something? Well,
but yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Matt. Thank you. In the context of
this might be what you're thinking of. Let me back up because you were saying about standard error. So if we so I have this thing, right? So perhaps you were looking at the source code to myread.c, which here calls fprintf on standard error. Yeah, so this is intentionally printing to standard error instead of standard out. So you know, I guess the idea here is this program, my read, you know, let's say it's reading 5 bytes from input. So it read ASDFG, those 5 bytes. Well, okay. What if, you know, if I'm trying to write this character, you know, and just, again, imagine that this is like some important format that like only, you know, I have some, you know, it's writing an image file or it's writing an audio file that, you know, an image reader or an audio program would know how to interpret. If we wrote this to some output file in some format, there goes my 5 bytes. Of course, this didn't do that at all, did it? Ideally, we would have seen this written to standard error because we don't want that in some output file dot format. Except that it did happen. So let's see, why did that happen? The usage. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. So this usage message, this is the thing that like, you see how I redirected my output to some output file format, but I still got my error message on the screen. And again, you know, this is sort of assuming that like this error message would like break the format of whatever I was trying to write here. So there's this idea that we separate, error messages. I mean, the other thing I'm thinking of is like, you know, and those of you who are at the attack defense CTF we did a few weeks ago. So I was like running TCP dump, which is this thing that records network traffic, and I'm recording this to a file. But I still want to see like a message from TCP dump, like when it fails or whatever, I want to see it on my screen, and I don't want my file being like corrupted by whatever that error message is, because this file I need to read in Wireshark later. So separating the output of regular output and error output is pretty useful.
Anyway, I guess what I was really kind of like interested in, because for some reason I thought, or at least maybe it's in my my shell, my tiny shell, basically the fprint stint, and then it uses standard error. And I was like, well, why am I, you know, using fprint standard error when I'm just like, you know, duping standard error to the standard in. And I thought maybe like, maybe it's going to, maybe like the errors are actually getting like written to what file standard error actually like pointed at originally, and also standard IO, but it doesn't seem like that's the case.
No, dupe2 does a substitution.
Yeah.
So that so old...
That clears, what you described clears everything up for me, so I really do appreciate it.
Okay, great. Cool. Well, let's see. See, Andres is going to take a picture of the process graph. So I hope that you don't all think you're all off the hook just because he's going to do it. Y'all need to work on that also. Shell Labs due next week. We're going to post this video, and I guess continue doing class like this for the foreseeable future. I hope everyone's doing all right at your homes and everything. And I guess we'll get started on posting this video now. Thanks, y'all. And we'll do a little activity with file descriptors next week, and then move on to caching and memory and all kinds of other system stuff. All right. Thanks, everyone.